Welcome to episode 197 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off on SCScoops.com. It is Sunday, December 18th, 2011, TLC Sunday. I am the Solid Monster. Hope everybody's having a great weekend. Tonight marks the first WWE pay-per-view of the entire year, and probably even longer than that, that John Cena, the company's main attraction, does not have a match. And Cena himself on Twitter has claimed that he will not even be at the show. He'll be watching from home, which I'm not sure if that's accurate or not, but he is not expected to be on the pay-per-view tonight. And I know some people will take great pleasure in that. John Cena is greatly overexposed. People don't like him. I think it's, you know, it'll be an interesting test for them. I don't think this pay-per-view, quite frankly, is going to do any better or any worse. Certainly not much worse with him not being on the show. I think this pay-per-view is probably destined to bomb no matter what. It just feels like an unimportant show. And I would expect that there won't be any significant title changes or anything of that nature tonight. Let's just do a quick run-through of the card here, give some quick predictions here a couple of hours before showtime. There is a tables match, obviously the gimmick here, tables, ladders, and chairs, up and down the pay-per-view lineup. And Randy Orton and Wade Barrett will continue their feud. They have a tables match. And this is a match that obviously is it's an extension of their feud, and they're trying to build Wade Barrett back up after really breaking him down, quite frankly, over the course of 2011. You know, Wade Barrett, of course, with the Nexus angle last year, became a main event player in WWE and went over to SmackDown and led the core for a while until the core disintegrated. And then he really wasn't doing much of anything. And it's kind of a shame because, you know, Wade Barrett, I think he's a fine wrestler. But what impresses me about him is just his overall ring presence. I mean, the guy, does, you know, he goes out there, he's very sure of himself, he's very good on the microphone, and it's about time that they kind of swung back around to Wade Barrett and started giving him a little bit of a push, which they've been doing. But having said that, I don't think Wade Barrett goes over in this match. I think I'm going to go with Randy Orton here, just because, if no other reason, Randy Orton has been going above and beyond of late in helping to put other people over. You know, he did it with Mark Henry, and he's been doing it with Wade Barrett. You know, Orton took the losing fall in their Survivor Series elimination match. Wade Barrett and Cody Rhodes won that. I just think it's time that Orton goes over, and I think that's probably what we're going to see tonight. Intercontinental Championship up for grabs. Cody Rhodes, another guy who's been getting a big push of late, defending against Booker T, who is essentially coming out of retirement, I guess. First match that he's going to be having on WWE television in many months. And I don't think the end result of this match should be in doubt. I mean, I suppose if they wanted to keep it going, they won't have Cody Rhodes go over clean. Maybe it'll be some sort of DQ or something of that nature. The point is, Booker T is not leaving with the Intercontinental title. The entire point of this feud or this match, if this is the only match they do have, is to help elevate Cody Rhodes that much more by putting him in a special feud. You know, it's special because Booker T used to be a big deal. He used to be a world champion. 5 times WCW champion. And of course, he's been an announcer for most of 2011. But by bringing him out, it's really just intended to elevate Rhodes. There's no other outcome here that makes sense other than Cody Rhodes going over. And Booker T's been doing interviews of late talking about the fact that he's not even all that gung-ho about getting back in the ring. It's not something he wants to do full-time. It's not as though he's going to win the championship and actually defend it. So I'm going to go with Cody Rhodes here in this match. U.S. title up for grabs. Dolph Ziggler defending against Zack Ryder. I really wish they would have held out a little bit longer on this match so I can watch it. And just to really, you know, the build to this match, which has been spotty. You know, it's almost like they've been building this match for months, but not necessarily week to week. It's like sometimes they would push the Ziggler-Ryder feud, and then there'd be a week or two where each of them would do completely separate things, and it's almost like they wouldn't even acknowledge it. But having said that, this is one of the best-built mid-card feuds that WWE has had in quite some time. It's been going on for a while now, and I don't know how many of you actually watch Zack Ryder's YouTube show, but he's been doing a bang-up job of promoting this match on some of his recent shows. And on his latest episode, which I think was episode 43 or 44, he actually put together his own little kind of amateur video montage to some you know, background music and some clips of his feud with Ziggler over the last couple of months. And it was actually very well done, and probably did a better job on that video than WWE. I don't even know if WWE actually put together any sort of video package. They usually don't for some of the lower card matches. So I like the feud, and I do think it's time that Ryder finally goes over, but I just wish they would have done it on a show not named TLC. I'm going to go with Ryder. I think it's his time. Although, I'll tell you what, if Ziggler wins, but they keep the feud going, I almost wouldn't mind. I'd almost prefer that, quite frankly, some sort of screwjob finish and build to a match maybe on that January 2nd Raw that they're building up, or the Royal Rumble or something like that. But I do think that Zack Ryder will finally win the championship, so he's my pick in that match. Question is, of course, where do you go from there? Do you keep the feud going? Are you going to keep the belt on Ryder and really build him up as something special and have him defend the title against people? I mean, I could probably count on one hand the number of people that Dolph Ziggler has actually defended that U.S. title against in the course of several months. I don't even remember when he won the championship. I know it was many months ago. I don't remember who he beat for it. I don't remember when it happened. It's been quite some time. Triple H, Kevin Nash, and a sledgehammer ladder match. This is going to be quite interesting. This feud has been, quite frankly, I think this feud has been a bomb. Kevin Nash has really not done much of anything. He came in at SummerSlam after the main event, powerbombed the WWE champion. Powerbombed CM Punk several times, actually, pretty much without any retribution at all. You know, it seemed they were building to a Punk and Nash match, and it never happened. Wouldn't you know, the match never happened. And Nash took some time off to go film some scenes in a movie that he was working on, and Triple H, you know, got hurt in the injury angle, and he was off TV for about 5 or 6 weeks. And they had Triple H come out on Raw this past Monday night, which I reviewed in a special midweek sound-off I did, episode 196. So if you didn't listen to that, you can go back and check that out in the archives. But Triple H came out. He did a promo on Monday that I thought was good. You know, he did a decent job of building the matchup. Nash was not on the show, which was probably for the better, because realistically, what was he going to do? But even Triple H and Kevin Nash, who to me have never had a great feud, even their feud back in 2003, I would hardly call that great. But even that was probably built up better than this. This is not doing anything for me at all. And Nash, you know, I think Nash can be used in certain ways. He's a very witty, he can be a very funny guy, although since he's come back to WWE, he just doesn't, I don't know what it is, you know, he just doesn't seem comfortable. I don't know if it's the scripted interviews, but he just seems off. You know, some of his promos of late have been better than the ones when he first came in, which were just absolutely horrible. But Nash, it's just not working. And unless they have some other plans for him post-Triple H feud, I don't know if this is potentially the blow-off to Kevin Nash. I know he in storyline, signed this big lucrative long-term contract last month. But to me, you know, Triple H has to win this match. Clearly, they're going to be building Triple H up for probably Undertaker at WrestleMania. As, you know, the rumor goes, streak versus career, possibly with Shawn Michaels as the guest referee, which is what they were toying with last year, or rather this year, for the Undertaker-Triple H match, and they never did do that. It would appear as though that's the plan for WrestleMania 28. So, you know, what sense it would make for Triple H to be beaten here by Kevin Nash when he was already put out by Kevin Nash in a big injury angle? You know, this should be Triple H's revenge. And if anybody's going to be built up for a big match coming up at WrestleMania, it's going to be Triple H, not Kevin Nash. It'll be interesting to see how they work this, given that it is a ladder match. I'm still stunned that they're putting, of all people, Kevin Nash and Triple H in a ladder match instead of doing a tables match or, you know, even I know it's TLC, but even do like a sledgehammer match. You know, forget the ladder. Just you know, they've done pole matches before where you kind of erect a pole in the corner. It'd probably be easier for Kevin Nash to climb a pole. You can climb to the second rope, hold the pole for some leverage, and keep his balance. And he doesn't even have to climb to the top rope. He's already a big guy. Climbing a ladder, you're just inviting trouble, I think. I'm sure everything will be okay, but I just think it's really stupid to put these two guys, of all people, in the one sole ladder match on this particular show. So I'm going to go with Triple H here. I think he goes over. And where Kevin Nash goes from here, who knows and who cares? World Heavyweight Championship on the line. Mark Henry defending against Big Show in a chairs match. Mark Henry and Big Show now have been feuding for a couple of months. It goes back to July at Money in the Bank when Mark Henry beat Big Show clean. I believe that was where they did the injury angle to Big Show's ankle. And I'm ready for this feud to end. I really am. I just think this has been going on for way too long. And certainly I don't think it's time to take the title off Mark Henry either. That would be a huge mistake. Absolutely a huge mistake. It's bad enough that they've beaten Mark Henry on television several times in recent weeks. Seems like every time Mark Henry goes on Raw, he gets either jobbed out or he just doesn't look nearly as strong as he does on SmackDown. And you know, Daniel Bryan got a visual pin on him several weeks ago, and God knows Daniel Bryan's been treated like shit over the last couple of months. So it's time for Mark Henry to finally put this shit to bed, beat Big Show, retain the championship, and just move on to whatever his next feud is going to be. And I don't know what that will be, quite frankly, but I'm ready for it to end, and Mark Henry should go over here. Triple threat match, TLC. It'll be CM Punk defending the WWE title against The Miz and Alberto Del Rio. There really can be no other outcome here but CM Punk retaining the championship. I mean, they've played hot potato with this thing so many times, like 9 times since May or something like that. Something Punk specifically made reference to. They scripted him to make reference to that, you know, after he won the championship, or maybe it was right before he won the championship at Survivor Series. So they're even acknowledging on their own TV shows that it's ridiculous how many times the title has swapped hands in 2011. Just in the last half of 2011. And the plan was to keep the title on Punk probably through WrestleMania. And, of course, the rumors abound that Chris Jericho is on his way back on January 2nd. He'll be Punk's new challenger and all that. And I guess we'll find out in a couple of weeks. But if that's the case, it makes no sense to take the title off him here. So CM Punk wins. And perhaps, you know, he could transition into a singles feud with The Miz. But my bet's on him and Jericho probably going at it. And that'll be the next big feud to look forward to. This has the feeling of a really lame duck show here. And perhaps it will impress people. Oftentimes when people write off certain pay-per-view shows and don't give them any hope, and the pay-per-view will still bomb, don't get me wrong. I mean, business-wise, this show is just going to do shit. I'm convinced of this. But it could turn out to be a sleeper show. You know, there could be some really great matches on here. So if you're one of these people who's just interested in getting some good wrestling action, there is the potential for that on this show. I just don't like the idea of spending $40 or $50 on a show that just feels completely unimportant. So that's why I won't be watching the entire show live unless I can convince. I do have one friend who will sometimes cave, and I'll be able to go in on certain pay-per-view shows with this person. But as of my last checking, there is no interest in doing that. So if you order TLC, do enjoy the show. Let me know what you think. Wanted to talk about Raw one more time really quickly here. Again, for those of you who may have missed it, I did review the 3-hour Slammy Raw, which I was not a big fan of. I reviewed the show, actually, I think it was Tuesday night, so you can go back in the archives, check out episode 196 for a full review. But I was very impressed with the ending to Raw for Monday night. As a Kane supporter and a supporter of Kane and his old mask, it was very cool to see them actually follow through. As I said, they've been airing these vignettes over the last several weeks about Kane's resurrection and clearly showing him wearing his old mask. And it would have been quite the letdown to longtime fans for them to have brought this guy back without a mask. But they did. They did follow through on it. I thought the last, you know, 2 minutes of the show was actually very, very cool. It was a very cool moment. Kane came out wearing like a miner's mask, again, looking like some sort of evil psychotic welder, and took that mask off after chokeslamming John Cena to reveal his old half mask, hair and all. Somehow Kane has actually magically grown long shoulder-length hair back in the time span of about 3 or 4 months, which is quite the feat for somebody who's, 44 years of age. And I know there were pictures online of Kane with his family a couple months back, who growing his hair out, not to this length. Obviously, for those who have asked, yes, it's either hair extensions, a wig, something attached to the mask. It doesn't matter. It looked cool. I went back and actually watched this a couple more times, and each time I went back to watch it, I liked it even more. The Kane character has had so many rebirths and so many resurrections since 1997. Think about this for a second. Think about the longevity and the evolution of the Kane character over the last 13 or 14 years. I mean, how many people listening to this show right now who were fans back then could have honestly predicted that the Kane character would have the sort of staying power that it's had? Now, I don't just mean the fact that he's still around. I mean, you had guys like Billy Gunn and Hardcore Holly who were around WWE and part of the main roster for the better part of 15 years. You've had people like that on the roster before, but never anybody like Kane who kind of you know, he was this character that they created out of thin air as part of the storyline. Somebody to feud with The Undertaker. Let's give The Undertaker a brother. And we'll bring him in, and we'll put him with Paul Bearer, and we'll build up to a big match at WrestleMania. And I'm sure some people probably figured that perhaps the character would be blown off after that. And again, not only has this guy stuck around as long as he has, but he's been, for the most part, with a few exceptions along the way where they've kind of pushed him down the card, he's been a main eventer through and through. I mean, this guy was a main eventer from day one, you know, interfering in the main event of a pay-per-view, the very first Hell in a Cell, and feuding with The Undertaker. Not too many people can say that they've been able to come in and do that. Mick Foley probably would, you know, when the Mankind character debuted. He debuted on Raw the night after WrestleMania 12 and went right into a feud with The Undertaker. And not only that, but he actually beat The Undertaker in his first two pay-per-view matches against him back in 1996. So the Mankind character you can also cite as another example. But I just think it's quite amazing to look back. I mean, I remember reading, I mean, there used to be an online newsletter by somebody by the name of Peter Scaretta, who I believe currently writes for the Slash Film website. Doesn't really write about wrestling anymore, but he used to write author a wrestling online newsletter. Called himself The Slammer, I believe. And I remember when I was younger just reading updates from his little online newsletter. And telling me that, you know, the Kane character is still being discussed. They don't know who they want Kane to be or what he's going to look like. But, you know, they're considering this guy, Glenn Jacobs, who played Isaac Yankum, DDS. And at the time, you know, Glenn Jacobs was, I believe, the SMW World Heavyweight Champion. He was the champ in Smoky Mountain as the Unabomber. And he was the guy that they had handpicked, and perhaps Undertaker handpicked him, because Undertaker had worked with him before in WWF. And but this went on for months, because originally Paul Bearer came on television in June of 1997 calling The Undertaker a murderer and making reference to the fact that he had a brother who was still living. And it wasn't until October that the Kane character actually debuted. And who would have thought that all these years later there would be Kane still in the main event of Monday Night Raw in 2011, chokeslamming John Cena, coming back for... I mean, I've lost track of how many comebacks Kane has had. In a lot of respects, Kane and Undertaker, their careers mirror each other quite eerily, if you really think about it. Undertaker is the only other person I could think of who has had so many comebacks and rebirths and over the years. I mean, Undertaker would get hurt so often and need time off. He would just disappear for 3 or 4 months sometimes, and then would have a big comeback. And sometimes he'd be gone for longer, and then he would come back, and he would be the American Badass, or he would reinvent himself. He would you know, get new gear. He would try to freshen up his character. Kane has been the same way over the years. And Kane has maintained quite a bit of fan support over the years as well. I think at the end of the day, Kane is probably one of the best big men that WWE certainly has ever seen. Undertaker would probably be at the top of that list. You've got a lot of other guys like Bam Bam Bigelow and people like that who for being very big, either very tall or very heavy, have been very agile and very good performers. And Kane has not been lighting my world on fire as an in-ring performer this year, but there's something about seeing the big guy back in the bodysuit, which actually makes him look thinner, and back in the mask, and it's almost like you're transported back to 2003. You know, that night in Madison Square Garden when Triple H beat him and he was forced to unmask, and here we are. It's almost like we've come full circle now. And I just thought it was really handled really well. Where they go from here is anybody's guess. I'm pretty sure within a couple of weeks, Kane is going to lose that special feeling, and he's just going to become another guy. So for now, if you are a Kane fan, I would suggest that you enjoy it while it lasts. The other thing I wanted to comment on here is the fact that there were people apparently who believed or still believe that the Kane we saw Monday night was, in fact, The Undertaker. And when I first read this, I honestly, and I saw a lot of discussion about this on my Facebook page and on other websites as well, and I honestly thought that I was being trolled. You know, I got some emails from people asking, oh, it was Undertaker, was it him? And all I could do is just sit here and scratch my head and just, to quote Zack Ryder, you know, are you serious, bro? Are you really being serious right now? I don't see how anybody with two functioning eyeballs could possibly think that was The Undertaker. I mean, first of all, just thinking logically here, what sense would it make for them to be airing vignettes touting Kane's return? Kane, who has had nothing to do with The Undertaker, and hardly at all this year. I mean, I know they feuded last year, and Kane actually beat Undertaker 3 pay-per-views in a row, and Undertaker never got his retribution, which is kind of shocking. But, you know, what does one have to do with the other? You're promoting Kane's return. Kane's music hits. He comes out. Why would it be the Undertaker disguised as Kane? Can you explain to me what sense that would make? First and foremost, but even more so than that, if you look at the man, when the man came out, Kane is one of those guys. He's been a main eventer. He's been on the roster for so long. You could practically, you know, you've memorized his mannerisms. You've memorized his certain features of his frame. You know, I could just look at Kane's hands, for example, or at least the one ungloved hand he now has, and I could tell just by looking at the guy's hand, hey, that's Kane. Now, maybe other people are not as perceptive and they can't pick up on things like that, but it's not that difficult. The biggest thing of all is that at the end of the show, he took his one mask off to reveal the other mask, but he's wearing a half mask, which means half of his face is exposed. The lower half of his face is exposed. You can't tell me that that's Kane. You think, oh, God, it looks like The Undertaker. Half of his face is unmasked. He's been unmasked for now, what, 8 years? You still can't tell that this is Kane? That it's Glenn Jacobs under that mask? One of the best things about Kane being unmasked, and I wasn't a fan of him being unmasked back then, but the best thing that came out of it was how great this guy is with his facial features, for example, and expressing himself with his face. He's very, very good at that. Just by smiling or smirking a certain way or his eyes, he can really tell a story just by using his face. A lot of people can't do that. And Kane is a very kind of, let's say, odd-looking individual as it is. He was very good at that. It was almost a crime to think that they would ever put a mask back on him, even though I was in favor of that. So here's a guy who is wearing a mask. Half of his face is exposed, including his mouth. And if you go back to the last, like, 3 or 4 seconds, you see him smirking. It looks exactly like Kane. It is Kane. How people could think otherwise is beyond me. It's just completely ridiculous to me that people would even think that. I think you just had somebody who was trolling, and it just kind of spread like wildfire. And once you plant the seeds of doubt in people's minds, people tend to see things that aren't really there. They start to look and go, oh, wait, you know what? You might be right. Maybe I think that is The Undertaker. No, it's not The Undertaker. It never was The Undertaker. Don't fall for this, people, please. The only other time that Undertaker ever dressed up as Kane, it was one episode of Raw back in 1998. Okay, long-ass time ago. And that was back when Kane was still, you know, wearing the original full facial mask. So it was part of an angle. I think if I remember correctly, it was The Undertaker and Kane were feuding at the time to see who would challenge Steve Austin to a title match, either at King of the Ring or SummerSlam or something like that. And I remember Undertaker ripped the mask off and revealing it was him in the Kane outfit. I think he was standing in the ring with Vince McMahon at the time. And it was part of a storyline at the time. They were feuding. It made sense. And you couldn't tell it was The Undertaker necessarily. I mean, actually, some people could. Because, again, Undertaker also is kind of tall and lanky in a different way. He has a certain body type. But his face was completely covered. So at least then you could say, wow, you know, I didn't know that that was The Undertaker under there. How people could even think that this was The Undertaker is beyond me. So, yes, I'm convinced that this was just a bunch of people who were trolling me and other people who just fell for other people's BS. Don't do that. One of the other big stories of the week involved Triple H. News came out about Triple H's new philosophy with respect to WWE developmental, which, of course, he now oversees. And I was actually kind of... I laughed when I read this, and I see people commenting on it about, oh, this is going to be so good, and Triple H has the right idea. Basically, the idea is that Triple H and certain people in WWE, from here on out, they really want to make sure, because they realize that they have a certain drought of great new talent. I mean, they've got actually a number of talented guys right now in FCW, some guys who have already been brought up to the main roster, guys like Husky Harris, and Byron Saxton, and people like that, who were brought up and either were not used properly, or had their legs cut off and were sent down for whatever reason. I have no reason, for example, why Husky Harris was sent down to developmental, other than he's fat, and they don't like fat people, because I thought he was doing a hell of a job, and he had really big breakout potential, and he looked different, and he was just this hard-hitting guy who would, you know, go in there and smash you. And they just sent him back down. And you know, there was even a period of time in FCW, pictures came out where they put a mask on him. They put some sort of weird white mask on him. They tried to give him a character. I think they dropped it. They don't know what they're doing. They really don't know what they're doing. And Triple H has come to the same conclusion and realizes that, listen, I'm responsible now for developmental. I want this thing to be a success. You know, they gave him credit for the signing of Sin Cara, even though that was bullshit. He didn't sign him. They gave him credit for the signing of Karma, who was on the right track, and they were doing a hell of a job with her. And if that's, you know, Karma is a sign of how Triple H wants to handle things in terms of new debuts and new arrivals, and I'm all in favor of it, because I thought everything about Karma was great. I mean, the build-up to her, the theme music, that evil, creepy theme music they gave her, the whole entrance of her just coming out and beating people up, and, you know, the spotlight is on her. You know, she's not just some random person that nobody cares about. She would walk down very slowly to the ring. People in the ring would pause in their tracks and would be terrified of her. And people really started to think that Karma was a big deal. And then, of course, she announced that she was with child and would have to take time off. And, you know, I actually, at the time, I was kind of stunned at how they handled Karma's disappearance. They actually just had her go out on Raw after building her up as this monster who didn't speak. And she basically just came out and did a shoot promo about the fact that she's going to have a baby and she's got to go away. And I thought, that's kind of odd, since you're building Karma up as this unstoppable heel diva monster. But realistically, when she comes back in a couple of months, I presume, people aren't really going to remember that one promo she did in the ring with the Bella Twins. But Triple H has this idea that he wants people to be brought up when and only when they have a solid idea for them on the main roster. You know, Triple H is a big proponent of having vignettes, for example. He doesn't like people just making surprise appearances on Raw, which there have been examples of this working in the past. Every now and then I think it's fine to have somebody, you know, come out of the crowd or come out from under the ring, have a really impactful debut. That's how Big Show debuted. You know, that's how Brock Lesnar debuted. Brock Lesnar came from out of the crowd, out of nowhere, with Paul Heyman, and just started beating people up. Brock Lesnar was a monster. And things turned out pretty well for him before he decided that he didn't want to do this anymore. So that's essentially the idea that Triple H has here. You know, they don't want to call up guys from Florida and then just have them flounder with nothing to do. How many times have we seen this? You know, Jackson Andrews, the big guy they brought in to be Tyson Kidd's bodyguard, and then they realize, boy, this guy's no good. Let's take him off television and put him back down in developmental. You know, I mean, it's crazy, and you could easily have your career killed. You know, you only really have one chance to make a really good first impression. That's an expression that goes for anything in life, and it's really no different in wrestling. You come, you make your debut, and if you get beat in your debut, if they make you look like a jobber, if they bring you up and build you up for a couple of weeks, and then they just cut your legs off and send you back down, or in the case of Spirit Squad, they put you in a box and they ship the box over to Ohio Valley. Whatever the case may be, we've seen this time and time again. And if they're finally realizing, if they're finally coming to their senses and realizing, we can't do this anymore, we need new stars, let's build them up the right way, then hey, I'm all in favor of this. I just think it's kind of funny that this was a big news story this week. You know, the headline should have just been WWE pulls their head out of their ass, because this is something that anybody with half a brain could have realized years ago. But it took them this long to realize, after ruining several careers, I'm sure, over the course of the last several years, it took them this long to realize, huh, perhaps we should handle things in developmental a little bit differently. And on the same note, Dean Ambrose worked WWE house shows. He actually worked a live event in Fort Myers, Florida, Friday night. He lost to Daniel Bryan, two men who were very familiar with each other as they competed on the independent circuit. Seth Rollins is another example, you know, the former Tyler Black of Ring of Honor fame, who's been also floundering in Florida now for what seems like years. It probably has been a few years now. And supposedly, as rumors go, he will be on the road with the main roster as well, as early as this week. And the Ambrose, Daniel Bryan, I think they've had two matches so far. And supposedly, these matches have gotten rave reviews. I mean, what a shocker. Bryan Danielson and Jon Moxley having a match and getting rave reviews. There's something I never would have expected. But you know what? Listen, we can sit here and talk about how these guys should have already been on the main roster, and they should. I mean, guys like Ambrose and Rollins are probably better than most people on the WWE roster. I mean, they've got, and especially Rollins. You know, Rollins is kind of a tall guy. He's got a good look. He's a good worker. I don't know if he's, you know, a blow-away guy on promos. I mean, Ambrose has really impressed me in that department. I mean, there was video online of CM Punk on his day off a couple months back, you know, crashing an FCW show and actually having a match with Dean Ambrose that was better than anything I had seen on WWE television probably in weeks and weeks. It was great stuff. You know, but they wouldn't, you know, a guy like Punk would not go down there and do something like that unless he, in his heart, felt that he was helping put over a guy who deserved to be put over. I mean, there are guys on the main roster who have worked with guys like Ambrose and Rollins before. I have no doubt you bring these guys up to the main roster, you know, even if they wrestle a safer style, so to speak. These guys are going to come up and they're going to impress a lot of people. They're going to blow you away in a lot of different ways. And it's good to see that they're getting rave reviews. They're finally getting a chance to work with the main guys. And hopefully it won't be very long before we see these people on TV. I really think, you know, Rollins and Ambrose and guys like Hero, Chris Hero, if he ever comes over, and Claudio Castagnoli, and even Husky Harris, and, you know, Richie Steamboat, who I've seen a couple of his matches, is pretty good. These guys are going to be the future of the company. How they debut and how they make their first impression on television to the audience is going to be a very important thing and a very important indicator of how well they're going to do long term. I don't want to see them fuck it up for these guys. You know, I'm excited that they actually have a couple of, you know, diamonds in the rough, if you want to call them that. There is hope for the future, because right now, you know, things are I don't know. In some respects, they just feel very stale. It's nice that we have CM Punk as the WWE champion, and it's nice to see people like Zack Ryder on television getting an opportunity, Dolph Ziggler, Cody Rhodes. This is all very good, but we need some more fresh faces, and I think these guys are perfect for that. And if you've never seen their matches before, you can go on YouTube and very easily find FCW matches with these guys. There was actually, I think, a 30-minute, might have been a 30-minute Ironman match that Ambrose and Rollins had just a few months ago. So they work well even together. So good stuff. I am very much in anticipation of seeing them on television to see what they do with them. Dave Bautista was in the news this week, former WWE and World Heavyweight Champion, lashing out again at his former employer. He was doing an interview to promote his direct-to-DVD movie, Scorpion King 3. I had forgotten there was even a Scorpion King 2. I believe that was Randy Couture who was in that movie. But Batista has a role in Scorpion King 3. He's out promoting the film. And, of course, he gets asked questions a lot about WWE. Would he go back? What do you think of the current product? And Batista really has said in multiple interviews, he doesn't really pay much attention to the product. He really doesn't. And you get that sense. I mean, if you talk to him, I mean, I haven't talked to him, but these people who are talking to him when they interview him, he's a very laid-back kind of guy, and he's running his own MMA gym in Florida. He's, you know, acting in certain movies like this, and I just get the impression he's not exactly sitting there every Monday night watching Raw. He just doesn't care. But in this interview that he did with the Daily Star website in the UK, he actually, this is a direct quote from him about the WWE product. He said, quote, "It's brutal. I can't watch it. I can't connect with it. I no longer know this business. I don't do PG wrestling. Love me or hate me, when I was there, everyone took one look at me and knew I could beat someone up. I don't think they look at Miz the same way." I think that's funny because I even said the same thing about Miz a couple weeks back when they did the angle with Morrison. And he took John Morrison out, and they really were trying to... And then he did that promo in the ring where they zoomed in on the Miz's face, and it was almost like they were trying to turn him into some sort of psychotic killer type character that you were supposed to be really intimidated by. He's a dangerous man. You know, he could attack at any time. And I just can't look at Miz that way. You know, I just can't. You know, there are some guys who are well suited as heels to be that sort of cold-blooded, very intimidating, tough guy kind of character. The Miz is absolutely not that kind of character. The Miz is the classic chicken shit heel who does anything to win and can get under people's skin because he's really, really annoying. And I think he can even be a big babyface one day. But I just thought it was kind of funny. They were trying and are still trying to build The Miz up that way. And I don't know of hardly anybody who can actually look at The Miz and think, you know, this guy intimidates me. So it's funny to hear Batista saying the same thing. Although I you know, I'm sure he wasn't trying to take a personal shot at The Miz. It is interesting that Batista would say, people would look at me and know I could beat someone up. I'm sure that Dave Batista could beat the living shit out of me. He could probably beat the living shit out of a lot of people. But it was funny for him to make that comment, and I wonder what the reaction was behind the scenes in WWE. Because Batista, at one point, was actually you know, kind of in Vince McMahon's doghouse, because there was a backstage fight back in 2006, an altercation between Batista and Booker T that Batista got the short end of. You know, Vince McMahon obviously has this love of big men. And I'm sure he always looked at Big Dave as being the big tough guy. And as the story goes, you know, Booker and Batista didn't like each other. Booker thought that Batista was full of himself. He had a poor attitude, which he probably did. And there was one particular event behind the scenes where they had a scuffle. And by all accounts, Booker T won that fight. And Vince McMahon couldn't believe it, you know. He couldn't believe that here's big, bad Dave Batista all jacked up to the gills, losing in a fight to Booker T. All due respect to Booker T, who I'm sure is also tough. But Vince couldn't believe it. And Vince was very hesitant for many months to put the world title back on Batista because in his view, as like an old school kind of wrestling promoter, how could he put the world championship on a guy who got beaten up backstage? You know, so it's kind of funny to hear Dave talking about, oh, I could beat anybody up, and well, you couldn't beat Booker T up. So that was one very big exception there. Although they did work with each other, they were very professional. I think they had a match at SummerSlam that year, so they did work with one another. And Batista eventually did get the world title back because, let's be honest, who else were they going to put the world title on back then? I think Batista got a title shot every other month. I mean, Batista got so many title shots, it was just the point of high comedy at one point. But anyway, Big Dave, not a fan at all of the current WWE product. And, you know, blaming John Cena for the PG direction and all this. And he did go on to say the difference is that guys like Steve Austin, The Rock, and Triple H had to have the living shit beaten out of them to get where they are. He said they went through wars, and the audience knows it, and the audience appreciates it. The guys today will never get to that level. It's sad, but that is the reason for it. And, there is something to that. There's, you know, if you look back at guys like Austin, Rock, Triple H, Foley, Undertaker, I mean, these are grizzled guys who, you know, had to go through shit for years and years before they became a main event guy. And in wrestling, it's very different now. You know, you could be brought up from developmental and get a shot. You can, you know, you could be pushed into a main event position within a few months, you know. Guys like Seth Rollins and Dean Ambrose are of a different breed in that they cut their teeth on the independent circuit for many, many years before they finally got noticed and hopefully now are going to get an opportunity. You know, I don't look at those guys any differently. I think they busted their ass to get to where they are, too. It's just a different time. You know, you could talk about the territories and all that kind of stuff. You know, I watched the Steve Austin DVD recently, and it really struck me how different the wrestling business is now compared to the way it used to be. And, you know, Austin, of course, was in various territories. He was in Dallas, and he was in, I think, Memphis, and eventually made his way to Atlanta and WCW and all that. It's just a very different time. And for Batista to suggest that guys these days will never, ever get to the level of those guys, I don't know that I would go that far. I think in 5 or 10 years, people are going to look at Randy Orton and I don't know about John Cena, but they'll look at people like that a little bit differently in that they'll see these guys as kind of the old guard and, you know, the grizzled veterans, and maybe they'll have a little bit more respect for John Cena. Maybe not. Maybe John Cena will go down as hated up until the day he retires. But I just thought, coming from a guy who was a WrestleMania headliner and former world champion, who people said, you know what, he's going to leave WWE, and he lives a very lavish lifestyle. Big Dave can't be without a big payday. He's going to come back to WWE within 6 months or a year. Well, he's been gone for longer than that. And he doesn't show any signs of wanting to come back at all. And I just think it's just an interesting viewpoint that he has on why things are the way they are. I'm not going to go so far again as to say that, you know, the business is doomed and people are never going to look at it the same way again. But he makes very, very valid points about how different things are today than they were then. But, you know, for him to kind of lump himself in that category, which, I mean, he didn't necessarily lump himself in with Rock, Austin, and Triple H, but it's almost, he was speaking almost as though he was part of that old guard, which, again, is very funny because he was not part of that old guard. He came up in the current generation where, you know, he didn't work territories back in the day or anything like that. In fact, when he got his first big break, he was already almost 40 years old. You know, he got lucky. He got very lucky. Wanted to mention something regarding TNA. I haven't mentioned TNA much lately. Talk about a lame duck promotion. These guys got to get something going. I don't know what they got to do here, but they're not exactly setting the world abuzz, TNA is. But they had their Final Resolution pay-per-view last weekend, and they had a Bobby Roode, AJ Styles main event. It was a 30-minute Iron Man match, which went to a draw. There was no sudden death on the pay-per-view. They went off the air with a draw, Bobby Roode apparently retaining his world championship. And at the very next set of TV tapings, which and this aired on Impact this past Thursday, I caught the opening of Impact. They actually had 5 more minutes with AJ Styles and Bobby Roode, essentially a continuation of the pay-per-view main event for free on Impact right at the top of the show. And I did watch the final minutes, the final 10 minutes or so, I guess it would be, of their match. And they went 5 minutes. Again, it was a draw, essentially, no decision. Sting comes back out and gives them another 5 minutes, and they keep wrestling. And Bobby Roode beats AJ Styles clean with a one-leg crab. I guess he was working over AJ's ankle, puts him in a crab, wrenches back on the knee, and AJ Styles taps out. Bobby Roode retains. Always nice to see the world champion beat his adversary clean that way. And I guess Bobby Roode now will transition to a championship feud with Jeff Hardy. But I've seen people up in arms about the fact that why would they give away the ending of this pay-per-view match for free on television for the people who paid to see Final Resolution? And to that I say, who paid to see Final Resolution? Let's be honest. How many people paid to see Final Resolution? 24, maybe? 38? Nobody ordered that pay-per-view. Now, not nobody, I shouldn't say that, but the point is this. How can anybody get upset when TNA does shit like this anymore? You know? It doesn't even bother me. I mean, obviously, I am not in the demographic of people who are ordering their pay-per-views. These pay-per-views that are getting less than 10,000 people purchasing them each and every month. But this is what TNA does, you know? Even when they do good. And I think the Bobby Roode thing right now is great. I really do. I think it's actually refreshing to have somebody other than Kurt Angle, somebody other than Sting, somebody other than Jeff Hardy holding the championship in TNA. And hopefully this is all going to culminate in a couple of months with Bobby Roode reuniting in a feud with James Storm, and they can go at it for the championship, the two former members of Beer Money. And hopefully Jeff Hardy is nothing more than a transitional challenger for Bobby Roode en route to James Storm. At least that's what, you know, I would certainly hope. But this is what TNA is notorious for. They don't care about their pay-per-views. They basically admit it every single month without coming out and saying it. We don't give a shit about our pay-per-view shows. So, you know, and they know they have a certain number of diehards, just like WWE will always have a certain number of diehards who are going to watch Raw, who are going to order the pay-per-views. Those numbers are dwindling, but those people will always be there. And they take them for granted, and TNA just doesn't care, because to them, the television show is more important. And in one respect, I could see why. You know, they have a certain relationship with Spike TV, where they want to make sure their numbers, you know, obviously they would love their numbers to go higher, but TNA seems to always be stuck in this rut where the numbers do not change. I mean, they literally do not fluctuate more than 0.2 percentage points in the ratings every week. And they figure, well, as long as we can maintain that at least, we'll be in good shape, because if they ever lose that TV deal with Spike, the company is dead. They're done. They're finished. They're toast. Vince McMahon will own the TNA tape library within a matter of weeks if that happens. So yes, I can understand their desire to want to make sure that Impact is as strong of a show as it can possibly be. But you know what? If that's the case, and I've thought this for a long time now, but here's the deal with TNA, okay? If that's what you want to do, that's fine. You want to make Impact the go-to show, pay-per-view shows be damned, we don't give a crap, that's fine. The time has come for TNA to beat WWE to the punch. You thought I was going to say for TNA to beat WWE. That's quite funny. No, but the time has come for TNA to beat WWE to the punch and make a bold move before they do. Because there's been a lot of talk about WWE moving their B-shows onto their new network and no longer putting them on pay-per-view. And it remains to be seen whether or not that's actually going to happen. TNA has got to beat them to the punch. They've got to, you know, grow a set of balls, make a bold move, and abandon their monthly pay-per-views in favor of maybe 4 annual shows. 4 annual shows would make sense because that works out to 1 show per quarter if you space them out. So let's say if, I think Lockdown is probably one of their bigger shows of the year. I think Final, you know, Bound for Glory is kind of their WrestleMania. They love to build it up as their WrestleMania. So Bound for Glory later in the year, you've got Lockdown earlier in the year. Take 2 more pay-per-view shows, okay? Spread them out over the course of a given year. And make those your 4 big shows. That way you can keep the focus on your television show. You want Impact to be as strong as possible. You know, you want to put big matches on Impact. Every now and then you want to have maybe a title change on Impact. That's fine. Because again, they've made that decision already. They want that television show to do well because without it, they're dead. Impact is their lifeline. I get that. So if you have four shows a year instead of 12, instead of forcing yourself to do 12, and you could say the same thing about WWE, those four shows now, in theory, they still have to be promoted, but those four shows in theory are going to mean so much more. And I'm not saying that if TNA does this, that Bound for Glory next year is going to be, you know, a pay-per-view that gets 50, 60, 70,000 buys. But you know what? I would say, I think that it has the potential to do that. Absolutely. I could see a pay-per-view for TNA getting 50, 60,000 buys. It's been done before. I think their biggest pay-per-view ever got about 60,000 buys for a Kurt Angle, Samoa Joe steel cage main event. Why? Because they promoted that match. They did a bang-up job of promoting that match. And they reaped the rewards from it. And of course, the end result was that they decided that we're never going to book another match that way again, and they went right back to doing things the way they always do them. And Dutch Mantel, who was the supposed architect of the promotion of that match, and had a very big hand and a very big role in the way that whole Kurt Angle Samoa Joe feud was kind of mapped out, was actually ousted from TNA in a power struggle later on when Jeff Jarrett was essentially removed from power. And there was a lot of tension behind the scenes with Jarrett and the whole Karen Angle thing. Dutch was always a very big friend of Jarrett's, and so he got sent home, which was kind of ridiculous when you think about the good things he actually did contribute to that company. But anyway, the point is, the time has come to make the move, you know? Don't be WWE's bitch and ride on their coattails and wait for them to make the big moves and then follow suit, because you know what's going to happen. You know that if they wait and they don't do anything, and if WWE actually goes through with this, okay, if they actually go through with moving their B shows off pay-per-view, and they only have four or five major shows per year, I guarantee you within a year, probably not even that long, 6 months, TNA is going to follow suit and announce that they too are no longer having monthly pay-per-views. And they're going to be WWE's little bitch and follow their lead. It's time for them to actually take the lead on something first. And I think this is a great move for them to make. It'd be a great first step. TMZ.com, I have to mention this, had an item this week, a story, about Hulk Hogan's ex-wife, Linda. Linda Hogan, who, as Hogan astutely points out, for a woman who hates him so much, she has not abandoned the Hogan name. I think her real last name is Claridge or something like that. But she continues to call herself Linda Hogan. And apparently she is checking herself into relationship rehab. She and her former, her 23-year-old fiancé, Charlie Hill. That's right, the kid that I think her daughter Brooke went to school with him. He is 23 years old and she is 52. And apparently they've fallen on some tough times, wouldn't you know? And they're going to appear together on this VH1 reality show. I guess they've both agreed to go on and they hope to fix what TMZ refers to as their crumbling relationship. And, what a disgusting, filthy tramp this woman really is. I mean, every step of the way, and say what you want to say about Hulk Hogan. I mean, God knows the guy has made some really dumb decisions. He said some really stupid things. And, as a one-time Hogan fan, it's actually quite disappointing to see him kind of tarnish his legacy in this way. But if there's one area that I have a great deal of sympathy with this guy on, it is on the subject of his divorce with his ex-wife. It has been a very, very nasty divorce. And she apparently, I mean, every step of the way, she has these rulings in her favor, and she's really getting a nice big chunk of Hulk's fortune, probably undeservedly, quite frankly. But then again, I don't know all the details of, you know, infidelity and all that, and I don't care about that stuff. But when I saw this story, I was so angry. You just can't help but have sympathy for Hulk Hogan in a situation like this. There's a video of him walking through an airport with his new wife, who at least is in her mid-30s, for crying out loud, not her early 20s. And you could tell, I very rarely have seen Hulk Hogan angry, like really angry or really rattled by something. He's always very cool, calm, and collected, very positive, right? He had this epiphany a couple of years ago. He had these things tattooed on his body. He's a very spiritual individual now, very positive. He only likes positive energy. If you tweet him negative things, he will block you on Twitter. But Hogan's walking through the airport. This was like a week or two ago. And he was, you could tell, he was angry. I mean, he was really, really angry. And this is over the whole, all the allegations that his ex-wife made about him being in a homosexual relationship with Brutus the Barber Beefcake and all of that stuff. And Hogan was really angry. I mean, and he basically said, listen, I'm not gay. If I was gay, I would announce it. I would embrace it. But he was really pissed off that, you know, Ed Leslie has like a 15-year-old daughter, and she has to be subjected to all these rumors and all these allegations. And then that's the same interview where Hulk made the point of saying, listen, you know, this woman hates my guts so much. Stop using my damn name. You know, you're not the real Mrs. Hogan. This is the real Mrs. Hogan right here. And, you know, it's gutter, trash, TMZ stuff, and I wasn't going to say anything about it, but when I read the story about how this wench is going on this reality show to try to repair the relationship that she has with a man half her age, the same person who went to school with one of her own kids, and here's a woman who apparently has trashed her own daughter. Apparently Linda has had some unkind things in public to say about her daughter Brooke, who apparently raised issues with the fact that her mother was dating somebody so young, and her mother took to a public forum to bash her own daughter. This woman is just bottom of the barrel. I mean, she really is. You know, Chris Jericho used to come out on Raw for many years and call Stephanie McMahon a dirty, bottom-feeding, trash-bag hoe. I think that describes Linda Hogan to a T. People like this just revolt and disgust me. And, you know, I already had an unfavorable view of Linda Hogan. I played the audio on my podcast probably 150 episodes ago, long time ago. The jailhouse audio tapes when her son crashed the car and, you know, put his friend in a vegetative state and he was sitting in jail. And they released the jailhouse audio of her on the phone with Nick. And they're both crying and she starts crying, "It's not the same without you. You know, I'm going down to the beach and you're not there with me." And all this bullshit that just made me want to fucking vomit all over my keyboard. And just from that point on, I saw this woman pretty much for what she was. And you read stories like this and you just realize it's people like her that are kind of, you know, it's the dirt on the bottom of your shoe type of deal. You know, people like this need to be fucking eradicated from this world. So I actually have sympathy with Hulk Hogan. I side with Hulk Hogan on this issue. I actually feel for the big guy. And hopefully this whole situation between the two of them could be settled and they could both move on with their lives and she could just go away forever. So I had to get that off my chest because I read this story and it's just, it's disgusting. All right, let's move on from that on to something fun here. I watched a movie. I watched a movie called WrestleManiac. And there may be some spoilers here, so don't listen to this and then complain to me that I gave away certain things, okay? Listen at your own risk. I'm warning you right now. WrestleManiac was a movie that was made back in 2006. And I actually have to thank Adam Daniel for posting a link to this movie on my Facebook page. The entire movie is available for free on YouTube with limited commercial interruptions. And actually, it's the same two goddamn Chase credit card commercials over and over again with the guy having triplets and the sports photographer, so you'll probably see the same thing if you watch it. But I won't complain because, as I said, the movie is full and the movie is free, and you can find it on YouTube right now. And the overall synopsis of the movie is that there's a group of people who are driving a van through Mexico. I believe they're going to Cabo or something like that, and they're looking for a location to shoot a very low-budget porn movie. And it's the director, three porn stars, one of whom is a former WWE Diva Search contestant. We'll get to that in a second. A fat camera guy and some pothead named Jimbo. Okay, that's the cast of characters here. They all get lost. They meet a stranger at a remote gas station, of course, because they're running out of gas and they're in the middle of nowhere. And, you know, the man gives them directions and tells them to stay away from the ghost town called La Sangre de Dios, which translates to the blood of God, not the blood of Christ, as they say in the film. And that's the basic premise. He warns them, if you have to go through that town, keep driving. Do not stop for any reason at all whatsoever. And Steve, who is the fat camera guy, recalls that the Mexican legend about a Mexican wrestler named El Mascarado, who became crazy and he started killing his opponents in the ring, you know, many, many years ago, and he was sent to this town to be, quote, fixed. So that's the legend. This crazy ex-wrestler was sent to this town and presumably is still there, and so therefore you must stay away from this town. So, of course, as they're driving, they crash into a boulder, which is just conveniently sitting right in the middle of the road. And they veer off, and they end up, the van stops right in front of the gate of La Sangre de Dios. which is this gigantic wooden, almost like a barrier, this giant wooden door. It basically says, do not enter, do not trespass. So, of course, you know, the van won't start, and the director decides, you know what, we're going to trespass. And he knocks the door down. He decides that they're going to shoot this film in a local bar inside. I mean, picture, if you will, this an old Mexican town or an old town in the Wild West or something, you know, where you're just kind of, you know, think The Quick and the Dead or something, you know, or Tombstone. Walking through, you have like the saloon, and that's what this place looks like. Completely abandoned in the middle of nowhere. And you know you're about to watch a really classy film when one of the main characters opens the movie with a graphic description of what a dirty Sanchez is. So just a word of warning there if you're not into that sort of thing. The movie stars Rey Mysterio, not that Rey Mysterio, but rather Rey Mysterio Sr., who is actually Rey Jr.'s uncle, if I am not mistaken. So a true Mexican superstar is the star of this movie here. He plays the evil killer luchador El Mascarado, perhaps the least intimidating horror movie villain in cinematic history. Especially at 5'9". I mean, at least if he was big, I sound like Vince McMahon here, I'm going into Vince McMahon mode, but at least if he was big, he might be somewhat imposing. But he's just your average-looking 50-something Mexican wrestler wearing a mask. And much like unmasking his opponents in the ring, he rips the faces off his victims and saves them on his wall as trophies. That's his gimmick in the movie. Okay, he rips off people's faces. And I was waiting for a cameo by John Travolta or Nicolas Cage, but sadly it never came. And actually, this movie would have been perfect for Nick Cage, considering his choice of scripts in recent years. This may have actually been an upgrade for him. One of the characters, the fat camera guy named Steve that I've referenced earlier, refers to El Mascarado as the best Mexican wrestler of all time, which I think El Santo might have something to say about that. And he is appalled that no one in the van has ever heard of El Mascarado, you know? And Layla. Layla Milani is in this movie. Layla Milani of WWE Diva Search and Deal or No Deal fame. She was the girl, she still might be, I don't even know. She was one of the girls that opened the briefcases on the Deal or No Deal game show. She is in this movie. And she actually plays Dallas, a porn star, along with her friend Debbie. And the two of them love to fool around on camera. Get it? Debbie does Dallas? How very clever of them. I will say that Layla in this movie is smoking hot. Absolutely smoking hot in this movie, which the movie itself is really just the backdrop to show off her incredible assets, shall we say. She wears these really tight shorts throughout the entire movie, and I do mean shorts. And later on, there's this one scene where she's being chased and she gets her shorts caught on something. And, you know, naturally, the shorts rip right off and she continues running in her underwear. Not that I'm complaining or rewinding or anything, but some of the scenes are just that cheesy in this movie. There's another scene where she's trying to hide from El Mascarado, who is terrorizing the group. And she's trying to hide inside of a kitchen cabinet, like a low-lying kitchen cabinet. She stuffs herself in there. And she's sitting in such a way where her legs are spread wide open. I mean, her legs are spread, and unfortunately she's wearing the shorts in this scene. This is before the shorts came off. But she's sitting in this cabinet, legs just spread wide open. It's such an obligatory shot. I mean, this film makes absolutely no apologies for being gratuitous. But anyway, back to the van. Steve is appalled that Layla and everybody in the van has no idea. They've never heard of El Mascarado before, this great Mexican wrestler. And Layla wants to know if he's cute. And, well, Steve sums it up best here.
Was he cute? Who, El Mascarado? Fuck no, he looked like hell.
By the way, there's a scene midway through the film where they discover that the only way to get rid of El Mascarado, the only way to beat this guy, is by taking off his mask. He is, in fact, wearing a mask in the movie. Because, you see, El Mascarado follows the rules of wrestling. I would love to know what these rules are, by the way, but they never do explain them. And in Lucha Libre, there is no greater shame than having your mask removed. If they take his mask off, they presume he will have to retire and go away. Seriously, this is what he said. This is what Steve said in this particular scene. Suffice to say, he did not retire at the end of this movie. I will leave it at that. But The reality is, it was every low-budget horror slasher movie you've ever seen. I am a sucker for low-budget horror flicks, so I actually enjoyed this for what it was. Make no mistake, it is a terrible movie. I mean, it is cliched. Most of the characters are completely unlikable, which is actually quite a big problem, I think, in most horror movies these days. You know, I guess they do that on purpose because they want the audience to actually want to see these people killed. To me, that goes against the entire premise of, like, a real quality horror film, but maybe I'm just in the minority on that. But as I said, it's cliched. The people in this movie are impossible to like. There's very little suspense. The kills are actually kind of disappointing, and the ending was really stupid. But it's a horror movie about a killer masked luchador, and they play some mariachi music during the credits. So if you have 75 minutes to kill, I could think of worse things to do with your life, like watching Raw any given week. See, I didn't give too much away there. I gave just enough away to whet your appetite to make you want to go and watch this movie. Although I will caution you, if you are against these sorts of things, there is quite a bit of foul language, some nudity, and some drug use in this movie. So viewer discretion is advised, blah, blah, blah. There you go. All right, I want to give some quick iTunes shout-outs here. As I say every week, if you leave a review for the show in iTunes, which is very easy to do, you can give the show a star rating and leave your thoughts. I will give you a shout-out on the show if you make me aware of it. So I want to give a quick shout-out to John Haney from Northern Ireland, one of our longtime loyal listeners. Really appreciate his support. And Sean Hamilton as well, who left some positive feedback for the show in iTunes. So I encourage you all to do so if you have 2 minutes to spare. It doesn't take longer than that. And a quick message to the dopey bastards who post in the comments section on SEScoops.com. There were some people or a person, whoever it was, bitching last week about the fact that I promote my Twitter and my Facebook and I mention iTunes and what a hypocrite I am because I take WWE to task for shoving Twitter down our throats like a kielbasa every single week and this and that. And, you know, to the little trolls on the board at SEScoops, you know, who I'm sure when he first said that, he thought he was really smart and he thought, man, I'm going to nail this guy. I'm going to make a really great point. I failed to see the comparison between what I do and what WWE does because, you see, I do an internet radio show, an internet audio show, whatever you want to call it, okay? And I promote my show by way of these social media platforms. Not all the time, but it's a way for me to spread the word about my show and get more support and make people more aware of the shows when they go up because unlike Monday Night Raw, I am not on television. I don't have a platform to advertise my show to 3.5 or 4 or 4.5 million people every week. And the other biggest difference of all between what WWE does and what I do, I don't promote Twitter and Facebook over and over and over again over the course of the 60 or 90 minutes that I do my show. I don't do it every 5 seconds like they do on Raw every single week. It puts me over the edge when I hear them talking about Twitter when there's a match going on because they don't have their priorities in check. It pisses me off when they promote Twitter and all of this social media bullshit about trending and this and that every 5 minutes. I don't do that on my show. Typically, I'll mention Facebook here and there if there's a reason to, if I'm referencing something on there, but I leave the plugs for the end of the show. So if you don't like it, don't listen. It's very simple. Don't listen. But I'm sure when this person made his point, he thought he was all, yeah, I'm going to really take this guy to task and prove what a hypocrite he is. All you proved is what an idiot you are. Let's be honest here. There is no comparison between me plugging my Twitter page or my Facebook page in the last 2 minutes of my show, as opposed to WWE plugging their shit every 5 seconds and literally turning people off from their show in droves. So, again, if you don't like it, don't listen. It's very simple. Okay. Let's move on to the mailbag here. If you have questions, and I'm going to promote my email address now, so don't have a stroke, people. It's thesolomonster@gmail.com. Maybe I should actually do a mailbag and tell people to send me questions and not give them the email address. Maybe that would be the smart thing for me to do. Jonathan Fleming writes in with a question here regarding Hell in a Cell. He was sitting at home watching the Hell in a Cell DVD and wondering, what do you thought about the six-man match for the WWE Championship back in 2000, whether that was a good idea or not? Do you think we will ever see one done with this group of wrestlers that we have now? I didn't think it was a good idea then. I still don't think it was a good idea. Hopefully they won't do one again. Putting six guys inside Hell in a Cell, it's just too much. You know, I honestly, I don't think that having anything other than a singles match, I guess you could do like a tag team match, or, you know, this year they had the first ever triple threat inside Hell in a Cell. I would say that would be the limit. I just think the more people you put in there, the more watered down it gets, and, you know, there's so many different things going on. You know, you could do a War Games match, like a 5-on-5. I'm a huge fan of the old War Games matches. Two rings, two cages, you know, 10 guys, 5-on-5, mass carnage. That's more of a team thing. It's more fun to get into. Just to take six guys in like a six-pack challenge, I mean, they do that so often where they try to stuff as many people into one match as they possibly can. And I just think it waters down Hell in a Cell. So I was not a big fan of that. Cody Short from Monticello, Mississippi writes in, would Chris Jericho be a better match for Undertaker at WrestleMania this year? I'm probably mistaken, but I can't recall the two ever having a one-on-one match at a pay-per-view together. That's because I don't believe they did have a one-on-one match at a pay-per-view. In fact, they hadn't had a one-on-one match on TV ever up until, I guess it would have been last year. And they gave that first match away for free on SmackDown. And they may have actually had another match after that, but the one or two singles matches they finally did have after all these years were not on a pay-per-view, which was kind of stupid, actually. But as far as Undertaker vs. Jericho at Mania, I've said before, actually, people have suggested that I'm not a big fan of that match. Even though Jericho's been gone, and now he comes back and he might be fresh, there's no suspense there. There's no way Chris Jericho's beating The Undertaker. I mean, realistically, there's no way probably that anybody is beating The Undertaker. Triple H or Randy Orton or anybody. Or even Sting, if they brought him in, which they're not. But to me, Jericho is the guy, you know, kind of guy who's been beaten so many times that you need to put him in there with somebody, Undertaker that is, where you could at least build some suspense. You know, John Cena is still the money match for Undertaker to me, just because you would have so many people convinced that Super Cena will prevail, and oh my God, they're going to make Cena end the streak. It would be hilarious just to watch people lose their minds. And they could have one or two great near falls in that match. Undertaker versus Jericho, doesn't really do it for me. Gary writes into the Sound Off, assuming the vignettes that we've been seeing on TV are for Jericho, which I think they are, and he's going to have the reported match with Punk at WrestleMania, do you think a few months' time will be enough to make it something people are excited for and want to see, or will it simply be overshadowed by Rock versus Cena? I think everything is going to be overshadowed to some degree by Rock versus Cena. It's the biggest match that they've promoted, really, in many, many years. It's a match that has been a year in the making in terms of the build-up. It is your WrestleMania main event. It is Miami. It is The Rock's hometown. Everything is going to be overshadowed by that. There's nothing you can do. If you build up Daniel Bryan to cash in and win the World Championship, it will be overshadowed. If Undertaker tries to go 20-0 in a streak-versus career match against Triple H, if they bring in Shawn Michaels, all of that, to some degree, will be overshadowed. There's nothing you can do about that. Is 3 or 4 months enough time to build up a match between Punk and Jericho? I think it's plenty of time. I mean, the key is in the build-up. Is it good or is it not? It's better than 4 weeks or 6 weeks. And who's to say that if Jericho doesn't come back on January 2nd that they don't have their first title match at the Royal Rumble? You know, I haven't heard that if Jericho does come back, that the first match between him and Punk will be WrestleMania. It could very well be earlier than WrestleMania, and then they could have a second match. You know, is that enough time? Well, I don't know. I guess we'll find out. The key is in the execution. I don't think Jericho would be coming back, if he is coming back, and that's not 100% guaranteed, but that seems to be the betting logic here. I don't think he would come back without a sound plan in place for where he wants to go in his first feud. And him and Shawn Michaels were pretty much hands-on with their entire storyline, their entire feud back in 2008, which was one of the best drawn-out storylines and feuds the company has had in years. And there's something to be said for that when you let these guys kind of do their own thing and you let them be creative and let them come up with their own stuff. And I'm convinced that if Jericho is coming back, that, you know, that's exactly what's going to happen here. You know, he would want to have the ability with Punk to put something special together, and they wouldn't disappoint. So we'll see what happens. But is 3 or 4 months enough time, let's say, if they're going to build up to a Mania match? I think it's plenty of time. What do you want them to do? You want them to wait 6 months before they do their first match? It doesn't make any sense. You can't do that anymore. Gary also got married last weekend, so congratulations to Gary. Many years of health and happiness with your new bride, or groom, I suppose. It's possible. Jagger writes in, do you think that the FedEx Forum in Memphis, Tennessee could host a WrestleMania one day, or perhaps the Bridgestone Arena in Nashville? I looked up the capacity, the seating capacity for the FedEx Forum, and for basketball, it's a little over 18,000. You figure, let's just say they could fit 20,000 people in there for wrestling. Probably, maybe even 21 or 22 with seats on the floor. That I just don't see it happening. I mean, they did have WrestleMania back in 2006 in Chicago at the Allstate Arena, which also fits in the same range of people, about 20,000. And ever since then, they've done full stadium shows. And I would expect them to continue to do full stadium shows, packing in 60, 70,000 people, with the exception of WrestleMania 30, which I would suspect they'll probably want to go back to Madison Square Garden for that, which, again, a very small building relative to the big stadiums, but it's the Garden. You know, they go back there every 10 years. It's what they do. I don't think the chances of them coming to Memphis or Nashville in a, quote, normal-sized arena, in a market that, quite frankly, is not a major market, you know, relative to New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, even Boston and places like that. I just don't see it happening, especially now that they have cities actually bidding for the rights to host WrestleMania. I suppose if the, you know, the city of Memphis wanted to post a bid, and maybe Jerry Lawler can get involved in that or something, there's that connection there. If they really wanted to, then absolutely they could do it, but I just don't see it happening. Alexander writes in, big fan of the show since episode 190. And every time I can, I download past episodes to hear your comments. First, can I get a shout-out to the girl I love? Her name is Isabella Castellani. So there you go. Isabella gets a shout-out from Alexander here on the show. His question is, do you think it was a mistake for WWE to give Wade Barrett versus Randy Orton away as a match at the Tribute to the Troop show 5 days before the pay-per-view? I think this slows down the match a little bit. I agree. I think it's kind of dumb to give the match away at all, in any capacity. I mean, yes, it's a tables match at the pay-per-view this weekend, so it has that gimmick, and you can make that argument, but to me, you're giving away a match that you're going to expect people to pay for at the pay-per-view. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense to me. It makes the match feel less special, and it's not something that, quite frankly, I would do, so I agree. I think it was a really dumb move on their part. Don't give matches away on television 5 days or 6 days before you expect people to pay for it on pay-per-view. Don't do that. That's really dumb. Joe from Trenton, New Jersey writes in. He just celebrated a birthday on December 15th, so happy belated birthday to Joe. What TNA wrestlers do you see WWE going after, or who would you like to see on WWE television from TNA? Well, it's ironic your name is Joe, because I'm going to mention Joe right now. Samoa Joe is somebody who I think could be a big deal in WWE, as horribly as his character has been treated and botched in recent years by TNA. I think WWE could do big things with him if they could get over his physique. I'm sure one of the things they would want him to do is do something about his physique, at least a little bit. And to be honest with you, I mean, Joe probably could stand to lose a couple of pounds for his own health, and he might move better, but still, you know, Samoa Joe is what he is. You take him or you don't. And he's got far too much talent to be used the way he's being used right now by TNA. And I know he's done interviews recently where he said, well, he still has about a year or maybe more on his TNA contract, and he's going to fulfill that contract. And beyond that, who knows? So he's not going anywhere anytime soon. But your question about what TNA wrestlers do you see WWE going after is a flawed question, because I don't see WWE going after any TNA stars, unless somebody like Jeff Hardy were to become available. Because they would love to have Jeff Hardy back, especially if he's getting his life back on track. They didn't want him to leave in the first place. They were willing to overlook certain issues to bring him back, and Jeff just didn't want to come back. He could be the one exception. But other than that, I honestly don't think WWE would actually take the initiative and go after anybody from TNA. Perhaps feelers could be sent out. It would have to be the other way around, I think. I just don't think they're tripping over themselves and dying to have anybody other than a Jeff Hardy or somebody like that from the TNA roster. Could Joe go there eventually? I think there's a better chance of Joe, for example, going there than AJ Styles. AJ Styles strikes me as the kind of guy who's probably a TNA lifer. And if that's what makes him happy, and he's been with the promotion from the very beginning, and he's established a name there for himself, and he must be doing decently, you know, to have kept re-signing with them over the years, then, you know, all the best to the guy. Because for all we know, AJ Styles goes to WWE, is deemed too small, and they don't do anything with him. And he's going to be on the road more. He might be miserable. You know, he does what he wants to do, and that's fine. I respect him for that. He turned down a developmental deal many years ago from WWE. I don't see him going there. But Joe, I could see going there. You know, people like Bobby Roode or James Storm, also TNA lifers to this point, could also be a good fit for WWE at some point. But obviously, if that were to happen, it wouldn't be for quite some time, seeing as how Bobby Roode and James Storm are figured quite prominently on TNA television these days. Corbin writes in, do you ever see John Cena leaving WWE for Hollywood like The Rock did, or do you think he'll be a WWE guy for his whole career? I believe he will be a WWE guy for his whole career. John Cena has been in several movies now, and not to say that Dwayne Johnson is some master thespian. John Cena, though, has way more work to do. Let's just put it that way, if he wants to really make a mark in Hollywood and open some eyeballs. I don't think the offers are going to be pouring in from people outside of WWE films to sign John Cena to a movie project. I guess he did film a role in this Fred 2 movie, this Nickelodeon movie, but I think he's honest when he says that, and realistically in wrestling, where else is there for him to go? I mean, if the movie thing doesn't work out, there is no other place in wrestling for John Cena to go. There is no WCW-type promotion. The idea that John Cena would one day go to TNA is laughable. So I think he's a WWE guy for the long haul. The other part of Corbin's question here, he makes a reference to William Regal. He wants to know my thoughts on Regal as a potential Hall of Fame candidate. You know, Regal is a great in-ring worker, he says, and has been in WWE and WCW since the early 1990s and has won 17 championships overall between the two. Do I feel he should go into the Hall of Fame someday? Absolutely. I think, again, the Hall of Fame is such a subjective thing. There is no formal process for it. The whole thing, in some respects, is a joke. Anybody could go in there. Fucking James Dudley, you know, Vince's father's old limo driver, is in the Hall of Fame. All due respect to Nikolai Volkoff, who was an established wrestler back in the day. If Nikolai Volkoff and Coco Beware can be in the WWE Hall of Fame, then why not William Regal? Regal has held numerous championships, even though he was never a world champion. He's competed for the two major organizations of our generation. And he's still going strong today, more so as an announcer than a wrestler. But he's an all-around great performer, very well respected by his peers, Regal is. He could be a great teacher someday if he wanted to open a wrestling school or be a trainer down in developmental. He has a lot to offer, and I think he absolutely deserves inclusion one day into the Hall of Fame. Golden Gloves writes into the show, a proud Englishman, he says, and firm supporter of the Barrett Barrage. That's how he says it, right? It's not the Barrage, it's the Barrett Barrage. He says, I've only recently got back into the WWE product since the Royal Rumble back in January after being immersed in the Attitude Era as an early teenager. At what point did breaking the Undertaker streak at WrestleMania start coming into the story? Did they plan a long streak like this from the start of his career? Or did they luck out and realize one day, hang on a minute, this guy hasn't lost yet, we could use this? It was definitely not planned from the beginning of his career. It was one of those things that just kind of evolved over time. People came to realize that this guy had not been beaten at WrestleMania. You know, when they had Undertaker win, for example, at WrestleMania 9 against Giant Gonzalez the way that he did, which was essentially just Gonzalez got disqualified for trying to smother the Undertaker with a chemical substance on a cloth. If they had intended on building the Undertaker streak up as something where he just beat people every year, year after year, they wouldn't have had him win that way so early on. As far as when the streak really began to come into play, as far as people wanting to break it, I could be wrong about this, but the first time I really remember it becoming part of the storyline where somebody wanted to break the Undertaker streak, I believe, was with Randy Orton at WrestleMania 21 back in 2005. It was, you know, the streak might have been mentioned, the fact that he had never been beaten. It might have been mentioned in passing before that, but that, I think, was the first time where it became an issue of, you know, this person wants to be the first guy to beat The Undertaker at WrestleMania. And they had Randy Orton on that highlight reel segment hosted by Chris Jericho when he brought Jake Roberts out to talk about what it was like to lose to The Undertaker at WrestleMania. So I think it goes back to 2005. Dan Kincaid writes in more with a couple of observations and questions. He says he could be mistaken, but on one of the recent sound-offs, I was asked if there were any matches that ended during commercial break with the results shown when the show returned. You said you couldn't really recall any, but I think I remember one. When the 1-2-3 Kid got his first upset win over Razor Ramon on Raw in 93, I'm pretty sure he won during a commercial. Like I said, I could be misremembering the question, so if I'm wrong, I'm sorry about that. I'm pretty sure that was not the case. Perhaps somebody else can verify this, but I am nearly 100% certain that that match did not end during a commercial break. It aired as is, so I don't believe that is the case, but if I'm wrong, I'm sure many people will tell me that. Other thing he mentions here in his email, he says that it seems like, with a few exceptions, the product of WWE as a whole is improving. There are still a lot of flaws, don't get me wrong, but the general quality is improving. I've got to tell you, I've been watching wrestling since I can remember. But honestly, I'm pretty sure that if I had not found your podcast a couple of years ago, I probably would have stopped watching wrestling a while ago. So thank you for keeping me interested. One more quick story about how wrestling got me a spot in my band. I auditioned on bass, and I did okay in the audition, but I was talking to the guys after, and they told me that they wore white, pink, and black. Not so much anymore. I replied, oh, like Bret Hart. Turned out they were huge wrestling fans, and I totally got in the band based on that. I've been playing with those guys for 5 years now, and in the last couple of months, I've actually turned my drummer onto the Sound Off. So that story comes from Dan Kincaid. Jacob writes in, wants to know if I watched Tribute to the Troops this year, and if so, what I thought of it. I did not get a chance to see Tribute to the Troops. I heard it was a good show. Some people seem to be pretty disappointed because, as opposed to recent years where the show was either overseas or perhaps it was domestic, but it was held outdoors on a base, and it was really a show dedicated just for the troops. It was not about angles. It was not about promoting a pay-per-view. It was not about storylines. Usually all the good guys went over, and it seems like this year it was just any other show it looked like. It was in a normal arena. I know it was just military people only, I think, and their families were part of the audience. But apparently, by reading the reports of the show and hearing from you guys, it felt like any other Raw show. They were promoting TLC. There may have been, you know, interference in certain matches or screwy finishes. So, I mean, look, it's still a nice thing for them to do. It draws attention to the troops and to what they do and the sacrifices they make. They have a great relationship with the armed forces and all of that going back many, many years. It's hard for me to sit here. First of all, I didn't watch the show. But second of all, it's hard for me to sit here and criticize WWE for trying to do something nice. Maybe it isn't quite as nice as it used to be many years ago, but it's still something nice that they don't have to do. So I'm not going to sit here and criticize them for it. Last question we have time for here. This one comes from Marcus. I was reading through Chris Jericho's Twitter, and he's been acting like an ass to a lot of people, and I was wondering if you would have any insight as to why he's been behaving this way. I recall on Sound Off 194, you said people have said in the past that Jericho can be a prick, and I was wondering if there were any infamous stories of Jericho being an ass. P.S. I've been a fan since episode 80 and have been hooked ever since. My inclination on this whole Jericho business, he's been posting a lot lately and just coming off as a real dick, and I think it just has to do with him trying to convince people that he's not coming back. You know, he keeps answering questions and telling people, I'm not coming back to WWE. I haven't been following it. Somebody asked him on Twitter about Kane's return, and he said, you know, he didn't watch it, and then he put as a hashtag, you know, same old shit, which that right there convinced me that he's coming back probably on January 2nd. Kane is actually an old friend of his. Kane and Jericho were and probably still are really, really good friends. And believe me, he would not be on Twitter saying, oh, Kane's back, same old shit. It's just his way of diverting attention, trying hard as he might to convince people he's not coming back, even though he is coming back. Which doesn't mean that there haven't been issues between him and WWE. Those issues were very real. The fact that he was not included in the WWE 12 video game was something he was very unhappy about. And that had to do with negotiations that were going on about him coming back or royalties and such. Where there's smoke, there's fire. But again, with WrestleMania coming up, with the ability to come back and probably book himself into a feud with the WWE champion and work with Punk, somebody who he likes, even though he may have said otherwise on Twitter, and he complains about people stealing his moves, it does make him look like a real dick. I think he's doing his character, his personal character, his human character, not his wrestling character, more harm than good. Because now, even if he comes back, you still have all these people that have been following his tweets for months thinking that this guy's a real asshole, he's a real jerk. As far as infamous stories about Jericho being an ass, I mean, the only one that really, the one in particular that springs to mind, and you can fall on either side of the issue here, was something that happened a couple of years ago when he physically punched a woman in the face. and I believe he was leaving a WWE show. I must have talked about it on the Sound Off at the time, unless I wasn't doing the Sound Off. This goes back a few years, and there was video of it, probably still is somewhere on YouTube. I think he was leaving the building, his car was being swarmed by fans, and some, I think it might have been a husband and wife or something, some idiots like jumped on the hood, and he got out of the car, and they got in his face, and there's video of him basically punching a woman in the face. And if I remember correctly, I don't think I faulted him too much, because it was almost a case of like trying to defend himself or... I mean, there's never really any excuse to punch a woman in the face, but I just remember it was just a really ugly situation. I think TMZ covered it. That's one example. You know, when he really gets set off, he's got kind of a short fuse. And I'm not saying Jericho's not a nice guy. I'm sure he is a very nice guy to his friends and everything. But in real life, he can be a bit of a dick. I mean, that's just, people have said that before. And when enough people say something, you should start taking it. It probably has some element of truth to it. So I'm not saying he's a bad guy or anything like that, but when he can be a dick, he can really be a dick. So that's just who he is. But the stuff that he's been saying, trashing WWE or people stealing my moves and I don't pay any attention to what's going on, I haven't watched any of these vignettes, it's all bullshit. You know, I mean, even if he is not coming back on January 2nd, which I'm now convinced that he is, believe me, he's on his way back. You know, he says now that he's going to be, I think, recording a new album, he just announced, between the months of January and March. How convenient that he would announce something like that. I don't even know if anybody asked him. He just kind of came out and, I think, and announced this. And how convenient for him to suddenly announce that he's recording a new album during those particular months. So all I can say to this is, welcome back, Chris. Welcome back.
Welcome back, welcome back, welcome back.
That's going to do it for the mailbag this week. If you have questions, you can email me. I won't tell you my email address because, of course, that would be me promoting my social media. And we don't want to do that and piss people off. Actually, fuck them. I'll do it anyway. TheSolomonster@gmail.com is the email address. You can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/Solomonster. Facebook.com/TheSolomonster. You can friend me on there. There's always some cool stuff being posted on Facebook. And, of course, you can subscribe to the show in iTunes. You go into iTunes, type in Solomonster, or just type in the full name of the show. It'll come right up. You can subscribe, and you will always be in the loop whenever there is a new episode posted, including those special bonus... I was going to say rare midweek bonus shows, but of late I've been doing them quite often. Do not expect that every week, by the way. I just don't want to get people's hopes up for that. Expecting a show, you know, 2-3 times a week. I do what I can. And whenever there is a new show that goes up, whatever day of the week it may be, it will pop up in iTunes and you'll be the first to get it. And you can subscribe to my YouTube channel, youtube.com/TheSolomonster. That's it. See, that wasn't too bad, now was it? It's like ripping a Band-Aid off, all you people out there who don't like the social media plugs. It is a podcast. That is how I am supposed to generate attention. I do not have a television platform. Get over yourselves. Next weekend is Christmas, of course. It's Christmas Eve and Christmas Day. I do expect to do a show, episode 198, next weekend. But if that should change, I will let you guys know. Otherwise, I guess we may have a Christmas show next week to do. That'll be something to look forward to. So until next time, be well, stay safe. Thank you, as always, for supporting the show. I really do appreciate each and every one of your help. Keep spreading the good word about the Sound Off. And until next time, have a good one, guys.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joel from Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solomonster sounds off on SEScoops.com.